time for Coffee with the Chicken Ladies, a podcast for people who love chickens.
Hey, everybody, and welcome. It's Christine Holly from Coffee with the Chicken Ladies. We're here, and this is episode number 51 of our podcast, where we talk about everything chicken, family, fun, and
more chickens.
We drink a ton of coffee. I'm talking a ton. But most importantly,
we hug chickens every day.
And kiss them, too. Don't forget, we brew coffee from a little coffee house here in Bel Air, Maryland. Holly Ann, what kind of coffee are we brewing today?
Apple pie.
I know. I'm so excited.
It's good.
This one. It is good. It has a different taste to it. I really love it. And it's really like fall.
It's very fall.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're ready to drink some coffee and talk.
Yes.
How are you doing?
Absolutely great. How are you?
Good. I'm getting ready for Thanksgiving, but this episode is going live on a very important day in my life, the birth of my first child.
Yeah. Happy birthday, Sophia.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
It feels like I just visited you in the
birthday to Sophia.
Feels like I just visited you in the hospital with baby Sophia.
Oh my goodness. Can you believe that?
Wow.
And we're holding her, and you made her little booties.
Oh, that's right. I knitted her little booties.
They're all saved up in the attic for her.
Nice.
Yes, I'm feeling really old. My oldest daughter is now 17. How can this be?
Holy cow. It's true when they say don't blink.
I know. Wow. It goes by so fast. So, Sophia,
we're turning a proper chicken lady out into the world.
Yes, we are. Happy birthday, baby. Break some glass ceilings. So, yeah, we're doing birthday stuff. But Sophia's really upset because she has a history test today.
Oh, man.
And she is trying out for swim. So she's doing swim trials.
Oh, wow.
So we're going to celebrate over
the
weekend.
She's got a lot going on. Yeah.
Busy 17-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going on over at your house?
Well, Bluebell is recovering nicely from her leg issue.
Yay.
Yeah, that's really good. Pete was out with the leaf blower, blowing the leaves off the top of the chicken coops.
That's always a fun day.
Thanks for doing that, honey, because we get massive amounts of leaves
you
on top.
You guys are right on the edge of the woods.
Yeah.
Literally the woods.
We're wooded all the way around.
So you'd get a lot of leaves. We get a lot of leaves on the one run. So hopefully soon we're going to be able to do a new roof on that one.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that is a job.
It really is. And also it freaks the chickens out a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Anything you do new around the runs,
yeah.
They're like, they all run together to one corner,
right.
And then they run to the other corner.
He's super quick doing it, and it has to be done, but yeah, I'm always glad when it's finished. Other than that, this cracked me up. We had a volunteer pumpkin that sprouted in the compost pile.
Oh, that's always fun.
And it grew across the bottom of the lawn, right up to George and Martha's run. And so we had our big frost, last week?
Yeah.
And all the pumpkin vine died, and there's this great big green pumpkin sitting in the middle of the grass.
Oh, God. So now you got to pick it.
Yeah.
And hopefully, I don't know, will it ripen?
It might. I'm going to put it on the front porch either way.
Let some sun hit it.
There's some orange on it, but it's mostly green, but it'll go on the front porch.
They've been watching
anyway.
It the whole time. They're like, oh, we can't wait till this thing's orange. And then all of a sudden, it's like, boom. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
So we're doing a lot of Thanksgiving prep over here. Mm-hmm. Going to have my parents and my family over. Just immediate. But it's always a busy day and a lot of prep goes into it.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of prep for one meal, that's for sure.
Well, see, I learned about 20 years ago how far in advance I need to start doing prep.
I know.
I knew you're the same way. But what I also decided is if I was going to do that level of cooking, I was going to cook enough that it was going to last for days.
Yeah. I mean, we do turkey here and I do a big enough turkey that we're going to be eating for days afterwards. Mm-hmm,
right, right.
Because we at least have 10 to 11 people total.
Right.
So you need to get a big enough turkey to feed everyone
sure.
And then to have leftovers because you're going to eat for at least 5 days.
Right, after. Right, exactly.
There's no way that I'm going to do all this prep for one meal.
I do like 10 pounds of mashed potatoes.
Oh my God, yeah. The mashed potatoes are the best. The kids love them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we'll be making the sweet potato casserole, which is
nice.
Definitely one of our faves here.
We're doing another one of your recipes today.
Yes, we'll be talking about cracking the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have another birthday coming up. Ella is the 24th.
And your birthday's after that.
Yes, all these November birthdays are here.
Uh-huh,
it's so much fun. Let me just take a minute to ask everybody a huge favor. If you're listening to our show and you're loving it, head on over to Apple Podcasts where you can leave us a written review. It does so many amazing things for our show.
And I want to give a quick shout out to Head Rooster. He knows who he is, who just left us a fantastic review on Apple.
We love these reviews.
You are not our only male listener, but we really appreciate you taking the time to leave us a review.
Thank you. Thank you.
You gave us a big smile. The other thing you can do to help support the podcast is visit our Etsy shop. We have our t-shirts on offer and two logo mugs
maybe.
Left. You can also check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/coffeewiththechickenladies. You can see our levels of membership, including a free monthly bonus episode. And the final thing you can do to help support our podcast is buy products from our sponsors.
Yay! We have some exciting news to share from our sponsor, Grubly Farms. From now until the end of November, you can receive 20% off if you're a first-time buyer.
We have a special discount code for our listeners, COFFEE20, for 20% off your first purchase. You can follow the link in our show notes. This offer does not apply to subscriptions and cannot combine with any other offers.
If you haven't heard, Grubly Farms has a brand new layer crumbles food packed with plant and insect protein, perfect for those picky chickens and ducks.
Plus, they're the perfect size for bantams and all products ship free.
It's a great time to try Grubly Farms if you haven't yet. Use the code COFFEE20. Try it today.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
Do you like subscription boxes?
Does it have anything to do with chickens?
Of course.
Then, yeah. Let me take a minute to tell everybody about the Chicken Love Box. If you love goodies for your chickens and you need to go to chickenlove.com.
I love the Mega Box. Tons of useful products and a chicken tee for me.
You can't go wrong with the chicken t-shirts. They are so cute and so soft.
In the November box, I absolutely love the blank chicken note cards and the refillable treat feeder complete with suet treats.
My favorites were those tea towels. They were so nice and thick with a nice chicken print. Hey, I'm going to use it for an oven pad.
Perfect. Boxes start at $39 per month. They ship immediately after your purchase and shipping is always free.
It's such a great deal. Don't wait. Get off the nest and click already. Chickenlove.com. That's chickenluv.com. Get your subscription today. Okay, so now it's about that time for the Breed Spotlight. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't sure where that was going. I wasn't sure that was going to end.
It is our fanfare for our Thanksgiving episode.
Yeah. Welcome to our Thanksgiving episode.
Today, we're going to talk about the
Pilgrim chickens.
Yes, but first of all, we have one certain one that we're singling out in the very beginning.
Right. So this is not a breed, but when it comes to early America, there were only a handful of breeds that we could talk about. So we're going to talk about a type of chicken that was regularly found.
It existed in the colonial times.
Right. And it has the charming name of the dunghill fowl.
It makes me laugh every time we say it.
Yeah.
And this chicken was definitely in colonial America.
Yes. The closest thing we have now would be what we call a barnyard mix or a farmyard mix chicken.
Right. And then if you're thinking about in other terms, it's basically a mixed breed, like a mixed breed dog or...
Right.
These chickens were walking around during the colonial times.
Right. I mean, we've seen in a lot of historical accounts and actually at living history museums as well, they will have what they call dunghill fowl. Now, in the 1600s, there weren't that many breeds of chicken, and there really weren't breed standards. You know, there were no breed clubs.
Right.
So chickens tended to be a type, and the existing breeds tended to be tied to geography.
So I'm going to list the chickens that this chicken could have been part
of
this
dunghill fowl, right.
Which is the Dorking, the Dominique, the Hamburg, and the Brackle.
Brackle/Campine.
Right.
Right, that type.
Those were the chickens that were walking around at this point that could have all been saying... Hey, baby.
Yeah, I guess maybe the Sussex, too. It would have to be really old breeds. We're talking specifically about New England right now.
Right.
But in other areas, maybe some of the French breeds, maybe a Crevecoeur.
Right.
Or like the Normandy chicken, something like that.
Right. But we're talking basically New England.
Right. We're sticking with Pilgrims since it's our Thanksgiving episode.
Happy Thanksgiving.
So essentially the dunghill filler, they're kind of a quasi-land race. They were essentially the result of complete free-range birds who just bred where they pleased.
And if you think about colonial times, these people came over to a land that was settled only in Virginia and with Native Americans.
Right.
So these chickens that were here were not like in a classic run, a coop. They're just running amok everywhere.
Generally. What I have found in my research over time is that settlers or colonists who wanted to maintain a breed, they usually had fencing to keep the birds relatively safe and to prevent crossbreeding.
Well, if we go through all of our historical sites that we have been through,
right,
we live close to a lot of them because we're in the Mid-Atlantic where everything kind of started.
Right.
So they did make fencing from cut logs and stacking. So they could have made them that way. But these chickens were not in any type of modern day enclosure. No.
It really would have been the wealthier people who were able to keep their chickens fenced. Yeah. Fencing was extremely costly, both in price for materials and in labor.
Right.
And it took a really long time to put up. Because in general, we're talking the 1600s.
Right.
The colonists were starting from trees.
They were starting from nothing.
Trees.
Scratch.
So they had to find a way to bring the trees down. And then they had to cut board or somehow split log, whatever.
And they were dealing with their own poverty, disease,
cold,
virus,
all those things.
Everything that they were dealing with. It was very, very primitive. So basically, these birds were just kind of left on their own to do their own thing.
Right. These would have been completely free-ranging birds, and they bred as they pleased. The name Dunghill Fowl, just charming, right? Comes from the fact that you could often find them on top of the manure pile or the compost pile.
Right. They were looking for food.
Right. And that's also referred to as the midden, both in colonial America and back in England. And what they were doing was turning over the compost pile to search for bugs and tasty treats.
I mean, it's smart.
Turning over a compost pile speeds aeration and helps the microbes live.
Yes.
It's almost like the chickens, the manure pile, and the colonists had this great symbiotic relationship.
Exactly.
Whether they realized it or not.
I mean, even the colonial chickens were before their time and smart, knew where to go.
Apparently so.
I mean, they were over there. Let me turn around this compost. Let me get some yummy bugs from
right.
it. But hey, we're also going to breed like
crazy. That's what they do.
That's what they do.
Essentially, because they were left to breed where they chose, they tended to vary in size and appearance.
Anything with land race
breeds
right. are like
well, and that's why I said quasi-land race breed, because I don't think they did this for long enough to form any new breeds.
Right, exactly.
They just essentially existed as a bunch of different crosses.
And as the pilgrims evolved, the chickens evolved, and then there were standards.
Right.
So this
down
was, we're talking early, early on.
Right. What we're talking about in this episode is the 1600s. That would have been the pilgrims settling
yes.
New England. And we'll make some references to Virginia.
Yeah.
Because the Jamestown settlement was already in place.
Right.
And they did have chickens.
Yes.
So the Dunghill Fowl varied in size, as we said. They would have been very hardy chickens. They had to survive.
Yeah.
They would have to be predator savvy and very thrifty at finding food, hence their time on the compost pile. So these smaller sized chickens, they would have been kept to manage pests.
Right.
Bugs and things like that. And for any eggs that they laid, they probably had to go out and search for the nest.
Right.
But they generally would not have been for meat at this period.
No. Generally, from the beginning of time, chickens were more about the eggs that they laid versus the chicken meat themselves.
Right.
So them giving the eggs, people would go out and search for the nest
right.
and find the eggs. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was a great source of protein for these people.
Oh, absolutely.
They definitely needed.
They definitely needed it. Yeah. There's a wonderful historical site in Massachusetts called the Old Sturbridge Village, and they maintain a flock of Dunghill Fowl, and I'll link to their website.
We might have to go and visit.
Absolutely. According to their website, the birds that they keep as Dunghill Fowl are essentially the result of their Dominiques and their Red Dorking flocks ranging together and crossbreeding.
Which we've said those two breeds were essentially some of
exactly.
the earliest chickens. So yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
We don't have egg-laying statistics or anything because they were not kept at this point.
We really have no record whatsoever. It was really interesting. I'm going to link to a podcast in our show notes. It's called Ben Franklin's World, and I've been listening to it a lot lately. And essentially, the podcast host is a historian, and she hosts other really amazing early American historians on there. And I was listening to an episode recently. It was about one of the earliest diaries that was kept by a female settler. And what she said was that women were taught to read because they were expected to read their Bible. They were not taught to write because writing was seen to be something attached to business.
Right.
So there's this rare diary that exists from the 1600s in America. And where I'm going with this is women would not have been keeping these records yet because most of them couldn't write.
Exactly.
So we don't know how many eggs the so-called Dunghill Fowl would have laid. We really don't know very much about them at all.
No. What we do know is they existed.
Definitely.
Basically on their own with their own survival skills.
Right.
And they were a mix of what started out as a few chickens and then basically they ended.
Right. We started to see some different breeds coming in. We started to see more breeds being developed.
And more breeds coming over on other ships more, that were coming in.
Exactly. As more waves of immigrants started to arrive in America, they were bringing their breeds with them. Have you heard of Strong Animals Chicken Essentials? They make natural supplements for your flock.
Strong Animals has used plant-based products and natural approaches to promote the health and vitality of backyard flocks. Their products contain organic essential oils prebiotics, and other natural ingredients to support the immune system and digestive health. Give your chicks and chickens what they need to thrive with Strong Animals Health products. Visit GetStrongAnimals.com today. We're going to switch over to our main topic. Yes.
Our main topic is Pilgrim chickens. Now, we spent weeks doing research for this.
You did the research on this, and it's amazing.
It was a lot of fun for me. So we're going to revisit the question, because this is Thanksgiving. We're going to talk about the Pilgrims and whether or not there were chickens on the Mayflower.
So we have kind of addressed this in our 4th of July episode.
Right. Episode 31, we do talk about this.
There were only written records of two dogs
being on the Mayflower.
On the Mayflower. And the conditions on the Mayflower did not lend to livestock coming over.
We'll get into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not really a huge point of contention. If the Pilgrims had had chickens, they would not have been the first chickens in America.
No.
The Spanish explorers probably brought chickens with them.
Correct.
And Jamestown was already settled, and they did have chickens there.
Yes. And we discovered that a lot of the chickens were from Haiti.
Right. That's where the Dominiques would have come from. In most cases, when ships set out from Europe to sail to the Americas, again, we're in the 1600s, they were outfitted with domestic livestock. They would have brought pigs, chickens, goats, horses, even sheep and cows when possible.
And here's the kicker. There is always a list of everything and everyone that was on board that ship.
Often you can still find the bills of lading, yeah.
Especially exactly.
For something like the Virginia Company.
Right.
And you do find this information on later immigrants, such as the Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Right.
You can find more information about what they brought. But the story of the Mayflower passengers isn't so clear cut. It's quite unique.
Right.
As far as immigration stories go. The Pilgrims that had boarded the Mayflower, they had trouble before they even left England.
We talked about this. They started in Holland.
Right. And most of them had been living fairly roughly in Holland.
They wanted religious freedom.
Right. And so they were kind of building their own separate church. That time in England, there was all kinds of civil unrest. We could fill hours and hours with that. So they had gone to Holland, and some of them were like living in wooden huts in the minister's back garden.
Right.
Just so that they could establish the separate church. They conceived the plan to travel to the New World and build their church there. They'd heard about successes in Jamestown, so they eventually found investors and they bought a ship called the Speedwell.
Mm-hmm.
Their plan was to set up a settlement in Virginia. Now, Virginia at that point was gigantic. It wasn't the state Virginia as we think of it.
We probably were included in Virginia at that point.
Most likely. I think Virginia territory in 1600 may have run up to New York. So what they were going to do is set up the settlement, and they were going to bring more church members over, and they were going to repay these businesses by exporting furs and fish and other natural resources from America. And they sailed from Holland to England on this ship, the Speedwell, and then they had an agent in London who was outfitting the Mayflower with supplies and provisions.
Exactly.
So their food, apparently butter was one of the foods that they had.
You can't go anywhere without butter.
They had armor, which was basically useless once they got to the New World.
They're like, what do I need this armor for?
Seriously. And they had guns, but nowhere near enough guns.
Yeah.
So it's pretty dicey what we know about what they brought over. I mean, they had some kind of meal or flour, things like
that.
Something
where they could make a bread, that kind of food for themselves.
Exactly.
Keep in mind, they did not know what they were coming into.
Not really. I mean, they were relying on what they knew of the Jamestown settlement.
Exactly. But they didn't know what crops are going to be growing here, what everything that was going to go on.
Exactly. So letters and other documents that were written by the Pilgrims really express how woefully unprepared they were for both the ship journey and the settlement.
Yeah.
Originally, there were two ships to carry them to America. A lot of people don't know this. So they had the Speedwell and then they had the Mayflower. When they left the harbor to go to America, the Speedwell started taking on water.
That's not good.
No, and it ended up being not seaworthy, and they had to turn around and go back to Plymouth Port in England. So they ended up living on shipboard for about 2 months. They never got the Speedwell properly prepared, so essentially, they ended up crowding like 100 people into the hull of the Mayflower.
They wanted to come, but the problem is their conditions were not good.
They were not good. They'd already been living on the ship for about 2 months. Everyone eventually had to crowd onto the Mayflower. There's no mention of chickens anywhere in this debacle. None of the letters.
I can't imagine them being able to take care of them on a ship for 2 months without anything else but being on a ship.
Well, then they finally left the harbor. Everyone crammed into the Mayflower. And the voyage to America took just over 2 miserable months.
Everyone has learned about this going through school, about the terrible storms they went through and everything.
The ship was small to begin with. Over 100 people jammed in. The storms, everything and everyone ended up being very damp. Yeah. Some prisoners developed scurvy from lack of vitamin C. There were other nutritional deficiencies.
It was not fun.
And a lot of people ended up getting sick, both here and once they reached the New World. Medical historians think it was most likely listeriosis.
Yeah. Awful. It makes sense.
Yeah.
This is what happens with a lot of explorers.
Right.
You know, you have these grandiose ideas. This is going to happen. But then when you put it out into a plan, sometimes a plan doesn't always come out the way you think it's
right.
going to.
They were down a ship.
They were down a ship. So basically, they all had to go in together. Thank God there weren't a lot of livestock on there. Thank God.
I mean, it wasn't a good atmosphere for humans, let alone chickens with their delicate respiratory
system. Or any
system.
Other animals.
Right.
Well, we do know that there were two dogs that survived.
Right. The dogs did make it. And then there's a question of feed for the animals. So chickens at that point would probably have been fed with scraps from the human food.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there wasn't a lot to share, right? And let's just say, theoretically, if there were chickens on the Mayflower, if they made it to the New World, who knows how long they would actually have lasted, because the pilgrims ended up living on the Mayflower for a few more months before they managed to create any kind of habitable buildings. And in that time, 50% of the pilgrims died from disease, starvation, probably hypothermia.
Thank God there weren't all the livestock on there at that point, because they wouldn't have survived.
And not to mention the cold.
And the people didn't survive.
Right. So they knew what winter was like in Jamestown, you know, from letters, documents, etc. And there was actually one person on the ship who had lived at Jamestown for a period of time.
Right.
Going back to England, wanted to come back. But they weren't prepared for the winters in New England. So there is one little thing we're going to touch on as we continue this story. And that is, could the crew have kept gamecocks? Because some sailors did at that time. They kept birds on board for cockfighting.
I could see that maybe. I don't know. To me, chances are no.
The crew is an interesting thing you don't hear much about. There's a historian, Rebecca Fraser, who's written two really excellent books on Mayflower history. And one of the things she talks about is that the crew of the Mayflower were not at all happy with the pilgrims.
Well, you can kind of understand that. These people are very strict in their religious beliefs. They were not an easygoing type of person.
Probably not. In fact, apparently we call them pilgrims. They should be called separatists because they were establishing their separate church.
Right.
But they referred to anyone who was not part of their religion as stranger.
Yeah. They were not an easy type of person to be like, okay, let's all hang and play some cards. You know, I mean, that's not the type of person that this was.
The crew did not like them. And then, I know this from listening to the Benjamin Franklin's World interview with Rebecca Fraser. The ship came in at around Cape Cod, and they wanted to go south. They wanted to go further south towards New York, and there were rocks, and it was really treacherous, and the crew was kind of rebelling at this point. They didn't want to do this. So they turned back around, and they stayed in the Cape Cod area.
And that's a cold area.
It's a very cold area, and there would have been a question of acclimating the livestock. The only livestock that Rebecca Fraser mentions is goats. So she thinks there may have been some goats that managed to make the voyage.
Goats are pretty hardy.
Goats are pretty hardy, especially if there's nothing for them to get into, like if they're kept safely.
Yeah, and first thing I think of with goats is they like rocks. They like to climb on rocks.
They do.
Everywhere you go.
Yeah, but on shipboard, goats. They would have had to keep them.
They
confined.
Would have had to have been in there. Like, that's why I'm saying, I don't know how any animal could have survived with all of
this.
It
would have been
down.
Awful. Again, if they had brought chickens to the New World, they probably would have ended up eating them. But here's what I imagine. They dock and they get the livestock off the ship right away because they would have needed to do that.
Yeah.
And the chickens, predators could have gotten them pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Especially if they were just going to let them range around.
The goats are less likely to be taken out by a predator.
At that time, there were some pretty big predators around. But yeah, I mean, certainly not like a chicken.
I think they could hold their own chickens.
Right.
They were the first to go.
The other question that occurred to me is, if some of the women had brought chickens, would they have even been mentioned anywhere? Because women weren't doing their own writing.
I mean, there's always that possibility. There's always the possibility that they were there.
I think it's a faint possibility. I'm just throwing out these possibles.
We know that there were two dogs for sure.
Right.
Other than that, we don't know exactly. So could there be a possibility? Yes. And there's a story that supposedly kind of proves that the chickens were on this Mayflower.
So to set the stage for this, we know that in 1623, the English ship, the Anne, arrived in Plymouth in July. The Anne was definitely carrying livestock. there were at least some cattle on board, possibly some other animals. And we also know from writings that from this point onwards, chickens are clearly documented. They're definitely in Massachusetts by 1623.
And this ship, it was probably better planned. It was a little bit later in time.
Right.
They had people sending correspondence back to England,
yes,
saying, this is what it's like over here. This is what we need.
Right.
So we know that this would have been a little bit more well thought out and planned. So that does make sense.
It does. So the story that supposedly proves the presence of chicken on the Mayflower concerns one of the pilgrims named Edward Winslow. Now, Winslow is not a name that we all know, but he was very active in the formation of Plymouth
right.
Colony. He would eventually become one of the governors of Plymouth, and then he later returned to England where he worked for Oliver Cromwell during the English Civil War.
Okay.
He wrote several published works about life on Plymouth Plantation. And I've checked this in so many different sources, and they say different things. So the story goes, in the early months of 1621, in the winter, which would have been...
Well, that would have been a year and a half then, before this ship arrived.
Yes. So in the early months of 1621, Massasoit, the leader of the Wampanoag people, supposedly fell ill. And the Wampanoag, they had been in that area of what is now the U.S. for like 10,000 years.
A very long time.
And Massasoit, the leader of the Wampanoag in this area, struck up a friendship with Edward Winslow. It's interesting because they apparently had a genuine friendship.
Yeah, why not?
Initially, Massasoit's interest with helping the pilgrims seemed to be reciprocal. They would supply the pilgrims with seed and help them sow corn.
Yeah.
They would teach them how to grow it. And in exchange, the pilgrims would supply them with guns.
Yes.
It's a very simple reciprocal agreement. But somewhere along the way, these two actually became good friends. So supposedly in the early months of winter 1621, which would not be that long after the pilgrims arrived.
No,
they arrived in November of 1620.
Yeah.
Massasoit fell ill and Winslow prepared for a state visit. We know that he took some kind of quote unquote medicine with him. We don't know what it was.
Right.
The popular legend claims that Winslow saved Massasoit by making him healing chicken broth.
Sorry.
Right? I know. It is funny.
I mean, even now everybody says chicken noodle soup heals.
Right. I know. That's one of the things that made me kind of really...
It is kind of an old wives' tale.
It is. Like, it is. Anyone who's sick really enjoys a nice soup, right?
Yeah.
So other sources claim that Massasoit asked for English soup because he had tasted it before in Plymouth, and Winslow did make him soup, probably using wild duck.
That makes more sense to me.
It does for a lot of reasons. The first, if this had happened in 1621, the pilgrims would only have been there a few months.
Yeah.
and I suppose that's long enough for people to strike up a friendship, but it doesn't seem that likely to me. We do know that the pilgrims ate a lot of wild duck and other wild fowl.
Yeah.
They did use their weapons that they brought with them
yes.
to hunt wild fowl. So it's possible that Winslow made him this soup using wild duck. Very possible. According to Plymouth historians, it's pretty definite that he did make soup or broth from Massasoit, as well as giving him this medicine. But no one knows for sure that it was a chicken soup.
Two Tylenol and call me in the morning.
That's exactly right. So then I found other sources that say this happened in 1623. And in that case, chickens would definitely have been present in Plymouth, but they were mostly kept as layers,
exactly.
not as a meat source.
At that point, people weren't eating chickens. This is the thing we've said since the beginning of time. Chickens equals gives us eggs.
Right. They were not looked at primarily for meat at that point.
No.
It was definitely egg laying. So there's the legend. We personally think that all the evidence together proves that there were not chickens on the Mayflower.
That's what I
They did arrive in the New World a couple years later.
There were already chickens here.
Right.
When
so
they
even
arrived.
If they had been on the Mayflower, they wouldn't have been the first chickens in America.
Just for fun, let's share some of the menu for the first Thanksgiving feast. Should we do this now?
Yeah, yeah. So we checked a couple sources for this. We checked with Smithsonian Magazine, History.com, and then Rebecca Fraser herself talks about this.
Yeah.
And she is a Mayflower Pilgrim expert. So the meal included several types of wild game. The Wampanoag people, we know for sure that they hunted and brought 5 deer.
Wow.
So venison was their contribution and a lot of it. There was also wild fowl that probably would have been hunted by the pilgrims.
Which would have been ducks, probably.
Probably ducks, goose, pigeons, and or wild turkeys.
Exactly.
So wild turkeys were very plentiful
yes.
at that point. So it's not 100% that there was turkey at the meal, but there very well could have been.
Yes.
Corn as well, in the form of cornbread or maize corn pudding.
I like myself some cornbread.
So do I, because we're Maryland girls. And you sometimes find recipes for this pudding called Indian pudding.
Wow.
Yeah. I actually made this several times when I was a kid just for fun.
Yeah.
And I think it was sweetened with molasses. But you don't find it so often these days. You find a savory corn pudding.
Yes.
But the sweeter corn pudding, you tend to find this in older cookbooks as Indian pudding.
Huh.
I mean, that's not the term we use for Native Americans anymore, but that's how you'll find these recipes. So we know from the very sparse written records that exist that these were the dishes definitely served. We also know that the Thanksgiving feast lasted 3 days.
Hey, it lasts that long now.
It kind of does. There were about 90 Wampanoag people in attendance and like 50 or 60 pilgrims.
Well, there should have been 100, but 50% of them died.
Right, yeah.
Due to how hard it was to get there.
Illness, cold.
Nutritional deficiencies.
All of these things, right. So other foods that could have been included that would have been plentiful in the region, one of the big ones is chestnuts.
They're good at this time of the year.
Right. They were one of the most important protein sources and at one point, one of the most plentiful trees in early America before the chestnut blight hit.
Basically, look right now in the New England, Mid-Atlantic area and tell me what is of season. And
right.
That's a lot of what they had then.
Well, I will say this year, however, my chestnut trees have zero chestnuts. Do you know
really? Why? Why the heat?
Cicadas.
Oh, yeah.
Because chestnut trees bloom on the end and form the chestnuts on the end of the branch, and that's what the cicadas ate.
They killed all of them.
So I'm hoping my chestnut trees will bear next year, but this year, we're chestnutless.
I'm going to list a few of the things that were plentiful.
Uh-huh.
Pumpkins.
Yep.
Squash.
Uh-huh.
Beans. And probably shellfish, which, let's think about New England, they're known for that.
Right, and they're right on the...
on the water.
There probably would have been some kind of wild herbs or and or greens grown by the colonists by this point, because there were some seeds that were transported that they would have tried to grow. Also around, probably dried wild plums, grapes.
And would cranberries. Have
been, plenty of cranberries.
Yeah.
They were all possible. No mention in any of the writings of any domestic poultry or eggs.
That's another clue in there that those chickens were not on that chicken.
Right. So again, if the pilgrims did have chickens at this point, they again would have been kept primarily as layers and to breed more birds because they would need more chickens.
And you would think that their dishes that they were making or whatever, they would have mentioned eggs for sure.
You would think so. I mean, I thought about that too. And I thought, well, if it was fall, maybe the chickens were molting.
Off lay.
Maybe it's possible. But still, I think you would have found more about them in.
For sure.
Yeah.
I believe that too.
So that's our pilgrim chickens. Overall, we think there probably were not chickens on the Mayflower.
Nope, I don't think so. That's my opinion.
My opinion as a historian. I mean, just the evidence doesn't point that way. But I thought it was really, really cool learning what was served at the first Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah. That's fun for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now it's time to move on to...
cracking the eggs.
Cracking those eggs. And this week, we're going to use a Thanksgiving recipe. Of course.
And whose is it?
Mine!
Right. This is Chrissy's stuffing. And it's really an interesting... I'm going to make this. Not necessarily for Thanksgiving, but just because it looks really cool. It's a fantastic stuffing recipe.
It's my pumpkin muffin stuffing.
Yeah, it's filled with all kinds of good stuff.
My mom, growing up, she said everybody did like an oyster stuffing or...
sausage or bread stuffing were the big things in our area.
Yes, they were the big things. So she wanted to go different. So she started doing an apple raisin stuffing.
Yeah.
And her stuffing was always so delicious. It was my favorite thing on the Thanksgiving table.
Stuffing is still my favorite thing.
I love stuffing.
And just for the record, my mom made sausage oyster bread stuffing.
That's what everybody was making.
Very appropriate, given there probably was shellfish on the menu at the first Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
But yeah, I'm really intrigued by this. It's filled with so much good stuff.
I changed it to make it my own from the apple raisin stuffing.
Okay. So the base is the pumpkin muffin recipe that we shared a couple weeks ago.
Over the last 10 years, I said, okay, rather than bread, why don't I take the muffins that are made with pumpkin and bake them a week or so out and let them dry and use them for the base of my stuffing?
Yeah, it's really good. If you did it last minute, you could probably cube them and throw them in the oven for 15 minutes and let them dry a bit. And if you're obviously going to make that pumpkin recipe, don't put the chocolate chips in it.
Don't do the chocolate chips. I swipe out, a lot of times I do walnuts and raisins for my Thanksgiving stuffing.
Uh-huh.
So the raisins are baked into the pumpkin bread, plus I add additional raisins at the end. So we're going to go through it all.
Yeah.
So about a week out, I make the pumpkin muffins. Mm-hmm. And we did that recipe a few weeks ago on purpose.
Right.
So that you would have this recipe and could make it if you wanted to try the stuffing.
Uh-huh.
You stick them in a bag with it open, so it lets them dry out just enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I do 6 jumbo muffins.
Uh-huh.
And this is for enough stuffing to feed like 10 people and to have for a day or two after.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It makes a lot. Then I go into, which is my saute list. I use the biggest pan I have.
Uh-huh.
And I saute all these things that I'm going to list together in about 4 tablespoons of butter.
And they're all essentially diced.
Everything's diced mm-hmm. or chunked.
Okay.
And if you are dairy-free, you can use a dairy-free butter
right.
to put them in.
Right. And obviously, you would have used a gluten-free flour for the muffins.
And that's the only thing that we've talked about before that you have to change with this recipe.
Right.
So it makes it easy.
Yeah.
So I use 6 apples, a mix of 3 gala and 3 green.
Mm-hmm.
And I peel and chunk them.
Okay.
And just dice them up. Not mm-hmm. dice small, but kind of chunked.
Okay.
I do 2 zucchini, which I peel and dice.
Uh-huh.
I do 1 large onion.
Or probably 2 small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
3 to 4 stalks of celery.
Okay.
About 3 carrots diced.
Mm-hmm.
And I saute all that stuff together.
Okay. In 4 tablespoons of butter.
And some olive oil also.
Okay. Or a dairy-free butter. I suppose if you were doing dairy-free, you could either do the dairy-free butter or you could do all olive oil maybe.
You could just do it in olive oil.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. So you're going to saute them until everything is cooked and soft enough mm-hmm. for chewing. The apples take a little longer.
Yeah. So start them.
I start the apples yep. first. The zucchini takes a little less time.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of, I add that towards the end.
Okay.
When that is about to be done, I take about a tablespoon, a big whopping tablespoon of minced garlic and throw that in.
A tablespoon.
Oh, yeah. Throw that in mm-hmm. and let that cook at the very end because you don't want to burn your garlic.
Right.
Once all that stuff cooks together, I crack 2 eggs into the mixture
uh-huh.
and scramble them with the whole mixture.
Do you kind of do it the way you would do it in a wok with stir fry?
Exactly.
Okay.
With a bite, you could get a little bit of scrambled egg.
Right.
So that's with all the veggies. And then at the end, I add about a half a cup of my 1.5 cups of raisins in and let them plump.
Uh-huh.
And let them cook with that just for at the very end with the egg.
Okay.
Let me go back to the saute pan because you need to make sure that's the biggest one you can get because you're going to be combining this all into the saute pan.
Right.
So then once all that stuff is cooked and sauced, and let me tell you, it smells up the kitchen.
I bet it does. Smells amazing.
It does. So then I crumble the 6 muffins into the veggie mixture and the egg.
I guess if you don't have a big enough saute pan, you could probably put the muffins in a bowl or some other kind of big dish and pour the saute stuff over top.
Like a big casserole
exactly.
dish. How about Pyrex?
Perfect.
Casserole.
Perfect.
That's actually what I serve it in because it goes from oven to table
yeah.
to fridge.
Mm-hmm.
So once I add those all together, then I add about another cup of raisins in
uh-huh.
and fresh seasonal herbs. So I grow rosemary, thyme, oregano,
uh-huh.
and sage in the garden. Every Thanksgiving, they're still going. I go out and clip everything for the day.
Yeah, I'm going to steal some of your rosemary. It looks
help
amazing
yourself.
Right now.
It's huge.
It's huge.
So then I sprinkle them in with the raisins.
Mm-hmm.
Once you mix it all together,
uh-huh.
you have the muffins in with the veggies and the eggs. You're going to need to moisten it a little bit.
For sure.
So you can use a vegetable broth or a turkey broth. And you're going to pour a little bit in so that the bread soaks in that broth
uh-huh.
and gets a little bit moist because you don't want your stuffing to be a dry stuffing.
No, not at all. You definitely need to moisten it.
Once you put it in the oven after that broth, it's going to take some of that liquid
right.
out.
Generally with stuffings, I usually make a big thing of broth ahead of time.
Yeah.
Usually more than they call for.
Yeah.
And add it as needed and toss.
Yeah, because the other thing is you don't want to make it like a glue. You don't
right.
want to put too much broth in so that it turns like
it clogs together, right.
Yeah. yeah. So you yeah. just want to moisten it enough so that it's not too dry.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I take about a cup and I heat it up.
Uh-huh.
And then I just, like you said, kind of spray, mix,
yeah.
and see how it goes. So once the broth is in, then I take a little bit of brown sugar and sprinkle the top.
Nice.
Bake it for about 30 minutes,
uh-huh.
let it heat through, and you're ready to serve.
Wow.
It gets rave reviews.
I bet it does. I'm going to try this before Thanksgiving because I'm so intrigued by it.
It's really, really good, and it's like hearty. So many good veggies in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a veggie stuffing side.
Yeah.
But it's really gone over well, and it was inspired by my mom's classic apple raisin stuffing where
right.
she used the diced breadcrumbs that you mm-hmm. buy and she kind of started all together. But I made my own spin on it.
Yeah.
When we first got married, it was funny because I would do mine and she would do hers and we would have 2 almost identical.
Oh, that is funny.
And then Joe and Michelle, my sister-in-law, they tried stuffing Okay. They cannot compete with my stuffing.
Oh, no.
They keep trying year after year to do like a sausage stuffing.
Uh-huh.
That's funny. They cannot compete. And you know what? If you needed a meat in this, you could add a meat to this.
Yeah, I guess you could. I don't think you need it, but if you wanted to.
You do not need it.
I would probably put nuts in it. I do put nuts in my stuffing. I also put apples in my stuffing. We'll do my stuffing next year.
Yeah. If you don't like raisins, this is the other thing that you can make your own. You can use something else dried, like cranberry dried, like raisins.
You could probably chop up prunes, maybe figs.
Yeah.
All those would be really good.
Yeah. And you can also add...
Oh, currants.
Yeah. And I add nuts in my muffins.
Mm-hmm.
So it does have some walnuts in there.
Yeah.
But you can take those out, add pecans, and mm-hmm. you can kind of make this your own. I will definitely this Thanksgiving put a picture of it up because yeah. it's so good. It's one of my favorite things.
And you have the egg in there. Yeah, I'm going to make this maybe this weekend. I'm so intrigued with it.
It could be a meal on its own.
Oh, absolutely.
Every time I make it for Thanksgiving, I'm like, why don't I make this more?
Yeah.
But then it's like, it's so special for Thanksgiving.
Exactly. And so, it's a process to make it too.
It is. And you have to be in the right vibe. That kind of sets us up to move on to retail therapy.
Retail therapy.
Yeah. Okay, so retail therapy, we're continuing with our Thanksgiving extravaganza.
Yes, we are. Yeah, this is fun. We're doing vintage chicken gravy boats.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you might think how many vintage chicken gravy boats could be out there.
Google it.
There's a lot.
There are yeah. so many.
So, yeah, we set up to see how many there were, and there are plenty. But we want to start off by giving a lead warning.
Yes.
Because some vintage ceramic pieces, especially the brightly painted ones, do have unsafe levels of lead.
Yes, they do.
So you could use them for flowers. They would make an amazing vase for flowers.
My tablescape, I love Thanksgiving. I bring in Joe. I tell him every year to go out. And we have so many tall evergreens on uh-huh. our tree. I'm sure everybody's seen it in our Instagram post. We have like 8 monstrous evergreen yeah. trees that border our property. And I say, can you go clip me a little bit of greens? He clips an entire branch.
I've seen what he clips. We made wreaths with the leftovers of what he clipped.
Like,
I know.
What are you doing, man? So I love making the table. And these gravy boats that you can't use, they would be so pretty on a table.
Yeah, you could do flowers in them. You could put other things in them. You could have a whole collection of them, say, on your sideboard. What you never want to do is never, ever heat food or liquids in them.
Anything vintage, you never right. want to put in the microwave or the dishwasher. Let's just
exactly.
put that out there.
Yeah. So we wanted to do a little research on these because this is our Thanksgiving episode.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Right. So gravy boats reached their peak of popularity before the Second World War. So I thought this was fascinating. They were included with most china sets in matching patterns. And, you know, before and even directly after the war, like when our parents got married, you generally got a whole china set.
You got a whole set.
As a wedding gift.
And it always had a gravy boat.
Yes. So before the Second World War, they were actually used a lot more frequently, not just for a few holidays a year. They would be used for, say, Sunday roast, things like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about the Sunday dinner, the family dinner.
Right.
It was a slower time.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone sat down and there wasn't a lot of eating out at restaurants. And you a lot of times had gravy with dinner.
Exactly. For some families, roasted meat and gravy was served pretty much every Sunday.
Yeah.
But when most of us think of gravy, we think of turkey gravy at Thanksgiving.
Yes.
But there are a lot of types of gravy and sauce, and they used to be part of a meal much more frequently than they are now.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot more choices now of gravies
mm-hmm.
that have just exploded in the last year or two.
Yeah, it's really
like
neat,
mushroom gravy, gluten-free gravies.
I've made red wine gravy.
You know what yeah. I love because I don't eat beef or pork. There are brown gravies that are vegetarian.
Right.
So, yeah. you know, there's a lot more choices out there. It's really nice.
It's a lot of fun recently. So back to the history. So what I found in the research is that there are some of the high-end China companies, and I mean really high-end, they might still offer gravy boats.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, like IKEA sells gravy boats in basic white, but they're no longer generally included in sets of China.
Right.
So you can get them, but not as part of a set unless they're vintage.
Well, here's the thing. You can go to any thrift store, say a local thrift store or a Goodwill, and you can have your choice of gravy boats.
Absolutely.
There's so many in secondhand stores.
And there are different types of gravy boats. And knowing what the types are makes them easier to find. Because
yes.
some of them, like I didn't realize some of what I was looking at were gravy boats and I overlooked them.
Which made me think of the big hen dish that you have
yes.
that we used for salad.
Yeah, that is a soup tureen.
It is, but then it reminds me of these gravy boats. Right,
we'll get to them in just a minute. Knowing what they look like makes them easier to find. So a lot of gravy boats are footed.
Yes.
And a lot of them come with matching saucers to sit on. Some are attached to the saucer.
Yes.
Makes them very easy to save.
Yes.
So think of the classic oval gravy boat. It has the spout at one end and a big handle at the other. They are the most common and the easiest to find.
Yes, they are.
And you can find them with chickens painted on them.
I want everybody right now, as you're listening, if you can, Google
chicken gravy boat,
mm-hmm. and you're going to be blown away by your choices.
There are also similar boats, but they look like they have a spout at each end.
Yes.
Now, you can use that as a pouring spout if necessary, but they're actually spoon rests or ladle rests.
Exactly.
And then finally, there are covered dishes that have the ladle and decorative lid.
Those are the most intriguing because they look like giant hens on a nest.
Yeah.
But they're bigger, and they do get bigger as soup tureens, like we were talking about.
So if you find one and it's too small to have soup served in it, it's probably a gravy boat.
Exactly. And yeah. They're so cool.
The most common form of gravy boat, which is that oval with the spout on one end and the handle of another, a lot of companies made it in the form of a chicken. Like the clay will have feathers and the pouring spout is generally a head with an open beak. So think like cow creamers. Yeah. You know, the tail is the handle.
Yes.
You can find colorful versions of them. A lot of them, again, are a chicken shape. A lot of them have lead in them. Yes. So watch that. Some hens on nests are actually gravy boats. That's where the ladle.
Exactly.
Yeah. You'll find the one that looks like a hen on a nest, but they'll either have the ladle sticking out, or more commonly, there will be a hole where the ladle used to be.
Yeah, and you can put your own like gravy spoon in
there. Yeah, absolutely.
Your own ladle. I said a gravy spoon,
again,
but I meant ladle.
Check the lead levels on them. You can probably put like a plastic sleeve in there.
Yeah, but what were you telling me? There was a place where you can look up. Yeah.
If you Google a set of china and lead count, it will give you the average lead count for that set of china. I checked a couple of our sets of china that way. One of them we can never eat off of.
Yeah. And like we said, they're good to have. They're good to pass down, but make it clear you can't eat off some of these.
Right.
They're going to be for your tablescape.
Yeah.
That's one thing that you and I love doing, we have in common, is we love setting tables.
Yes, we do.
And these things are awesome. You know, it's big this time of year. Figs.
Yeah.
You could line it, I guess, and fill it with the figs.
Yeah.
Because you're going to eat them out of that.
Well, if you're going to put something like that in there, I would just line it with cloth. It doesn't have to be anything rigid.
Exactly. Yeah. Or biscuits, if that's a bigger one.
Yeah.
And you could line it with a really pretty tea towel.
Yes. In fact,
use the chicken lump tea towels.
That's right.
But they're so cute, and there's a lot of them that you can use.
Definitely. And there are so many manufacturers that make them. I'm surprised. So some of the manufacturers we found are Franciscan. The Franciscans are often in the shape of the chicken and they're brightly painted, and they do have a high lead count without question.
Yeah.
So that's one that you would not want to put hot food or liquid in. There are a lot that came in through the Japanese import market, including Nasco.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of them, in fact. There's also Italian export or tourist market, including the Deruta Pottery Company. Made a lot of gravy boats with the chickens painted on them. There are lots from independent potteries. One of the most interesting I found was the vintage from the 70s plastic chicken-shaped gravy boat from the Soviet Union.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if there are any toxins in that or not, since it was made in the 60s.
That's a good tablescape.
It was a really neat collector's piece, though. One you find a lot of is produced in California. It's the Metlox Poppy Trail ceramic line. I actually have the platter from that line. And you'll find that in several different shapes with the rooster painted on it.
Oh, yeah. It's so cool. Now, everybody thinks about Thanksgiving. Everybody uses the turkey stuff.
Right.
But hey, us chicken ladies.
Oh, no, there's chickens on my table.
There's chickens on the table. I mean,
I do like a good turkey. I actually have a vintage Williams-Sonoma glass turkey cranberry sauce holder.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I have that. I bought that 20 or 30 years ago.
I mean, my mom supplied me after we got married with all the turkey platters, all that stuff. So I put that and I mix it in with my chicken stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I did miss last year was the bigger Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
This year, hopefully, my parents have their booster and everything.
Right.
So
Pete and I were on our own last year. And we absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
But it'll be fun to be at my sister's, and mom will be there this year. So yeah, that's good.
Yeah, that'll be good. But hey, check out these chicken gravy boats.
The final maker we're going to leave you with is Johnson Brothers. They make a lot of a lot of stuff.
A lot of.
I found several very pretty transferware gravy boats, some of them featuring chickens.
Yay!
Yeah, I found several of them on Etsy, as that's another good place to look for them.
I mean, I'm looking online, eBay, Etsy. Mm-hmm. You can find some modern day stuff, Williams-Sonoma, uh-huh. all these different places. And gravy boats can be stylish on your table.
You can use a gravy boat. Like we said, there are a lot of different kinds of gravies, but I've also seen them used for dessert, like for pouring cream or chocolate sauce or caramel, something like that.
Exactly. Be creative with them. Fill them with the variety of table nuts that you can put out.
Chestnuts,
walnuts, all these different things.
I really like the idea of putting fruit in them.
Oh, yeah.
That
lemons.
Kind of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything that you might
look pretty.
Be needing.
You know, it would look gorgeous if you used it as a vase and put your leftover herbs there.
This is what I was going to say. Every Thanksgiving, I take a big Pyrex bowl, one of the bigger ones uh-huh. that I have, and I get my onions, my herbs, everything out the day before, and I fill the bowl up, uh-huh. and I leave it right there so that everything is right where I need it.
And they've absorbed a lot of water, so actually they're perfect for arranging.
Yeah, exactly.
So what don't use, you can just tuck right in there. A bouquet of rosemary in the chicken gravy boat would be adorable.
It's natural. I like the Thanksgiving table to be what is
seasonal.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, check it out. It's the time to do it. It's Thanksgiving. Yay. So, what should we tell everybody that we're talking about next week?
Next week's another big deal.
Oh, yes, because it's our 52nd episode.
It is our 52nd episode. It is our 1 year anniversary as a podcast. Yeah. So, it's going to be a lot of fun. We are talking about the Sarama, our breed spotlight. Our main topic is ambassador chickens.
It's one of my favorite topics.
And we're going to have an interview with Jenny from Lipstick and Chickens. We adore Jenny.
Love Jenny. You love Jenny. She is the best.
She is. So we're going to talk to her. Cracking the eggs is one of my recipes. We're back to my recipes. It's something I've been making a lot recently, and it's delicious. It's pumpkin pie baked oatmeal.
But we're staying with fall.
Yes. And our retail therapy is Rooster Booster products.
Yay! What should we tell everybody to do?
Hug your chickens.
And kiss them too. And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to see more of us, please follow us on Instagram at Coffee with the Chicken Ladies. If you'd like to help us grow the podcast, please leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts. If you'd like to become a patron of the show, please visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/coffeewiththechickenladies. Thanks for listening. Ha 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 ha!